Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to another great episode we have here of Suspense Radio. I am your host, John Robb. Today we are back after a little two-week hiatus with a big two-hour show for you with four great authors we have coming up. First, we're waiting on the arrival here of our first author, Paul French. Then we're going to have Donald Allen Kirch along with Robert Bennett, and we're going to end the show with author Andrew Kaplan. A lot of exciting things going on, a lot of exciting things to talk about. We have a couple, three more audio clips we're going to play from books. So it's a very jam-packed, exciting show, and all that begins right now. Like I said, everybody, welcome back. Saturday morning here, a little early, about a little earlier than we normally do the show, which is okay because everyone listens to it on the archive anyway, so it doesn't really make a difference what time I do it here. But we do have a lot of jam-packed, exciting things going on. There's a lot of news that's been happening. If you've been looking at Amazon and Barnes & Noble with Apple and all the big six publishers going on, your head must be spinning, and we'll get into all that later. Right now, though, we want to welcome in our first guest, author of the book Midnight in Peking, and he is author Paul French, and we are pleased to have him on. So, Paul, we want to thank you so much for joining us today. How are you doing?
I'm very well, and thank you for inviting me, John.
Yes, and right now, you know, I want to remind everybody, your website is midnightinpeking.com, your news and events going on. Right now, you're over here in the United States. You're in Washington, D.C. You got some stuff going on about 1 o'clock where you're going to be doing some book signings. So how's all that working out so far for you, being over here and kind of going around the United States promoting your book?
It's been amazing so far. The response and the reviews, and you know, I'm almost scared to look at my Amazon ranking, because once you get into just sort of double digits, it's kind of quite exciting, isn't it? But yeah, and people seem to be really enjoying the story and really gripped by the sort of time. And I'm personally, as someone who writes a lot about Chinese history more than crime in the past, just fascinated that people are really into Chinese history.
Yeah, and the one thing, when you go on your website, and this has to be one of the greatest paragraphs, I think, for thriller writers that they love to see, is when you go on the website here, Midnight in Peking, you're going to see in bold right across the top, and it's going to read like this. In January 1937, Peking is a heady mix of privilege and scandal, lavish cocktail bars and opium den, warlords of corruption, rumors and suspicion and superstition, and the clock is ticking down on all of it. Now, what better stuff can you have in a thriller book than everything right there? Opium dens, cocktail bars. I mean, it's tremendous. How did you fit all that in the book?
Well, you know, that was Peking in January 1937. It was a country surrounded by it was a city surrounded by the Japanese. It was about to go to war, and you know, just like kind of Germany in 1938 or something, this was the last gasp. Everyone knew something bad was coming. You never know how bad it's going to be, but you know that tomorrow's going to be worse than today, so you might as well have a good time.
Yeah, and you know, and that's the one thing that a lot of people, especially over here in the United States and pretty much around the world, don't have any idea was what was China like in 1937, because they were kind of so closed off. You know, how were you able, the research must be intense to be able to get in to see all those kinds of things, because China being a communist country and being so closed off for so many years, it's just probably difficult to get that kind of history out.
Well, this murder occurred, it's a true story, and this murder occurred in January 1937, and I think the subtitle here in America is something like The Last Days of Old China, and it really was the last days. I mean, this murder happened in January 1937. In July 1937, the Japanese invaded China. They occupied and took Peking. And as far as I'm concerned, that's when the Second World War starts, really. I know that Europeans like me often think it's 1939, in America, 41 and Pearl Harbor. But really, when Japan invades China, at that point, there's no going back because, you know, resultant from that, the British Empire in Hong Kong, Singapore and Malaya collapses. And that just leaves two powers facing each other across the Pacific, Japan and the United States. And, of course, you know, there's no mystery there. We all know how that one ended.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And you know, what was kind of, you know, you have a lot of, you know, you grew up and born in London, you're educated in Glasgow, and then, but you spent many years and you lived and worked in Shanghai. Was that where you developed your love for, you know, Chinese history and then finding out that you wanted to be a thriller writer and kind of, like you said, this powder keg murder that happened back in 37, is that what piqued your interest to go ahead and, you know, write the book, Midnight in Peking?
I was one of these guys. I went off to university. I learned Chinese. I studied Chinese history. And then, of course, you know, once you've got a degree in Chinese, what else are you going to do, right? So you go to China.
Exactly.
And, yeah. Well, you know, you can work in a restaurant or you can go to China and be a businessman. That's basically your two businesses. That's your two options if you've learned Chinese. And, of course, off I went. And then, you know, rather unpleasantly, my government gave Hong Kong back to the Chinese. So I couldn't even get a civil service job in the empire anymore. I was finished. And I went out to China, and I was fascinated by this history of foreigners in China. Now, I've always read a lot of mystery books. I love reading thrillers. I love reading spy books particularly and so on. You know, I love Le Carre, you know, all the crime writers. I just devour that stuff. But I'd never thought of writing one of those. I just wrote history books about China. And then I came across this murder in January 1937 of a 19-year-old English girl who was the daughter of a British diplomat. And the case was investigated uniquely by a Chinese detective working with a Scotland Yard-trained British detective who happened to be in China at the time. And they worked to solve the crime. So really, I wanted to write about the end of that old China, before the war, before communism and Chairman Mao. I wanted to write about that unique period and the whistles and bells and the smells, the opium and the rickshaws and that whole world that's now disappeared. It just happened that I happened to stumble across this previously unsolved murder, and so I've sort of ended up being a thriller writer, a murder mystery writer by default, really.
And like you said, since this was a true event, and that kind of means that the characters were kind of already, you know, in play, it's not really anything that you had to kind of create. How much fiction is in the book compared to how much actual truth is in the book? So how much did you have to kind of make up to make the story, you know, wrap around? Or is the whole thing in the book actual 100%, you know, true?
Now, look, it's absolutely 100% true. There are no invented characters. There are no invented locations. There are no invented plot twists or clues even. And that's why when you read the book, at the back, I've footnoted the book. So that, you know, if there is no dialogue in the book that wasn't reported in an archive somewhere or in a newspaper article somewhere. So anyone who wants to go and check anything that's in the book can go to the archives in Britain, in America, in Hong Kong, in China, the old newspapers, and see it. Because I knew people would think, oh, you know, you couldn't resist adding something in. Of course, all the world of old Peking is from my sort of historical research over the years. But everything else is from archives. It's from the autopsy notes, the police notes, the diplomatic correspondents, the newspapers at the time. And I found, you know, half a dozen people scattered around the world who were alive at the time and in Peking who remembered those events. So I even was able to get that very crucial element when you're trying to rebuild what the world was like and what a case was like, which is the gossip that was going on at the time, which is often missing in these sort of books, I think.
And so, being kind of from China, and I, like I said, a lot of people here in the Western world just really don't understand that country. When you're going to research for this, is there a lot of pushback maybe from the Chinese government, or did you have any kind of anything like that while you were researching, since this is a true story and probably something that China really isn't probably proud of?
No, they were okay on this, actually, because what became clear very quickly was that, don't forget, this is 12 years before Chairman Mao and the People's Republic of China. This is Chiang Kai-shek and the old nationalist thing. So anything that says that there was chaos and not very good rule of law and order before the communists, they actually quite like in a weird sort of way. It sort of seems to bolster their case a little bit. And also, they're not really responsible for anything. And it became clear very early on that this crime lifted the lid on all the scandals, all the white mischief in the foreign community. This wasn't about Chinese politics. This wasn't even, you know, they ruled out very early that the Chinese person was involved. This was a foreigner on foreigner killing. So in that sense, there isn't really a problem with it. And in fact, there is a Chinese edition of the book. They're very keen, actually, to do a movie of it. Yeah, although there's going to be a TV version in the West, they'd like to do a Chinese language movie version of it. And they're sort of lapping it up because now, you know, all these years later, there is this great interest in among Chinese about what places like Peking and Shanghai were like just before the war and just before this massive change in the country. So there's a big appetite for that in China as well.
Now, I want to remind everybody that we're speaking with author Paul French, and his book is Midnight in Peking. The website is midnightinpeking.com. There's something that you did that was extremely interesting, I've never seen happen before, is when you go to the menu, you have an audio walk. Explain a little bit about what, if someone is going to go on your site and they're going to get down and they do this audio walk, what exactly are you walking them through? Because this is very interesting. I've never seen this quite done before.
Well, as you know, Peking, now Beijing, a city that has gone through just an incredible amount of demolition and reconstruction and urban planning since 1949. I mean, with the Olympics several years ago and everything, just incredible amount of rebuilding. And my book really takes place in several areas. It takes place on an old traditional street, one of the old alleyways of Beijing, what they call the Hutongs, which was called Armor Factory Alley. And of all the Hutongs that have been destroyed and over 75-80% of what was there in 1949 is gone, this one still exists. There was a place called the Fox Tower, which was an old tower. To give you an idea of this is a massive fortification on the edge of the imperial city that was built around the same time as the first production of Hamlet in London. It's an incredible building structure that shows how far really advanced the Chinese were at that time. It still remains, fortunately. There was an area where all the embassies and the legations were, where the rich foreigners lived, called the Legation Quarter, a square mile of European architecture in the heart of a Chinese city, mostly all still there. And most importantly, there was an area where the murder investigation centered on that was known as the Badlands, which was an area of drugs, pimps and brothels and bars. And in this area, everybody congregated who was really the lowlife, the underworld of China. And that area is still there. It's not the Badlands anymore, but it's still, you can still walk those streets. And I just thought, wouldn't it be great if people could read the book, try and soak up the atmosphere a little bit, and then do a walk through this area and see the actual locations in the book?
I think that it's fascinating. Not only do you have a map, because you also have what's called Pamela's Peking, and you have the map, what the streets would have looked like back in 1937. So you can walk around and you can kind of get the idea. So what you've done is you've been able to take the visualization, the visualization of, you know what I mean, the visual aspect.
Yeah.
The visual aspect of what everything looked like back then, to be able to have the reader have something to see, because it is just one of those cities that has been through so much tremendous change.
Yeah, and I just wanted people to be able to interact with the story and with Pamela as much as possible. You know, in a physical book, there's only so many pictures that the publisher will let you put in. And even with an e-book, there's only so many pictures you can do. And, of course, reproduction of pictures doesn't always look so great on the e-book format. And I just thought, let's just load up a website with as many pictures of old Peking in the 1930s, as many of the pictures of the characters, because they're all real people. So I wanted people to be able to see the minor characters in the book as well as the major characters in the book, the policemen, as well as just the streets and the characters of the city. And let's film some video of where we are. You know, I mean, nowadays we have the technology to do all of this. It is a true story. You can actually walk. You can see the houses where things happened, the police stations where the investigations happened, the place. You can stand on the spot where Pamela's body was found and the investigation began. You can do all of these things. And I just really wanted people, if they're interested, you know, to soak up as much of the documentation and the evidence. And I put some podcasts with people who actually knew some of the characters that I managed to find. And I just thought, let's just put all that on there and hopefully, if people enjoy the book, then it just becomes a more rounded experience for people.
Now, looking at the victim here, which is Pamela Warner, what kind of things can you kind of say, you know, that maybe did not go in the book or things that maybe surprised you while you were researching the actual victim, Pamela Warner, in the book?
Well, the fascinating thing about Pamela was that she was the adopted daughter of a very well-known British diplomat in China. And she kind of grew up in what we'd now call an expat brat. So, you know, she came from a very English family in the sense that her father was reasonably unemotional, but rather cold, as English fathers can be, I can assure you, John. Also, she was sent away to school at a very young age, which is another thing that the British do that I know Americans find slightly odd. And so she grew up being very independent in that sense. And she was 19 years old. She was 19 years old. And in the book or on the website, you can see her picture. When the two detectives came together, the British detective came from the town Tianjin, where she was at school. And he had pictures of her taken just a couple of months before she died, of her in her school uniform, in the netball team, in the hockey team, in the school photo. And in Peking, the Chinese detective had a picture that he had got from a local photographic studio, which is what I call her glamour shot, where she's posed in a studio in a beautiful dress with her hair and makeup done and everything. And from the start of the investigation, there were these two Pamelas, you know, and the question was, who was the real Pamela which was the Pamela that had got herself into some trouble that had led to her being murdered and everything. And what I found fascinating, because this book's been out in Australia and in Asia for a while, so I've already been talking to some book groups who've read it, and a lot of the women in the book group say to me, you know, 19, it's that real age when women have all the power. They're at their most beautiful. They're at their most alluring. Men flock to them, want to know them, want to take them out, want to spend money on them. And women, of course, are flattered, but women at 19 have none of the experience. They can't tell the good guys from the bad guys, you know. And so many women have told me that, you know, 19 was when they walked into a party and just thought, I really shouldn't be here. Or they got a lift home from a guy from a dance or something and just said, I shouldn't be getting into this car. You know, it's such a dangerous age, and there are people out there who you know, will take advantage of the naivety of young women, girls becoming women, you know.
Absolutely. I totally agree with all of that, because it is one of those, and I find it fascinating too when you're talking to a book club and they think that the age is probably 19. I don't know if that changes from country to country, saying, as you know, talking from Australia and now into the United States, that's kind of a very interesting approach. I would have never thought something like that, and I feel that that's the kind of feedback that you as an author love to get from book clubs, because it might be something that you never really even thought of.
Oh, well, John, I've got to tell you as well, the thing about book clubs that have shocked me is, you know, I'm just a guy who likes writing Chinese history, and I come across this unsolved murder from 1937 of an English girl, and I see her picture, and I just decide that I've got to try and solve this murder, and if I can't solve it, then I need to write a book so that her picture is out there, and her picture is on the cover, and people remember her. And there's some sort of, you know, I mean, one of the things about both everyone, whatever your belief system, whatever your religion, both Eastern and Western belief systems, is that there's something very disturbing about unsolved murder. You know, it discombobulates right. our sense of natural justice. So even remembering, you know, a murder victim, even if we can't bring complete closure and we can't see someone go on trial and be imprisoned and punished in some way, just the remembrance of that person is in some way an act of us reclaiming something for our society that says, you know, we don't forget people when they're murdered. And I thought that's what seemed really important to me. Now, when I've gone around these reading groups, and a lot of them are kind of, I think, a lot like your audience, John, they read a lot of crime books. They're really into their crime shows on TV. They're really into their police procedurals and so on. I've been amazed at how forensic the readers have been with me, you know, because they are asking me questions on minor details about, you know, well, you say she was wearing this, but then you don't say what happened to the coat after the body was removed. You know, do you think there might have been something there? I mean, there are so many people out there that could just be superb detectives, John. I don't know if you realize this.
I do, because whenever I see books, and it's almost, you just don't know the reader what's going to trigger themselves in the book. And it could be something like that. It could be literally to the fact of, hey, in book 10, you know, in page 10, you mentioned that she was walking along this street, but then something yeah. happened, you know what? And you just, and you're like sitting there going, how did they pick that little dinky detail out of that whole book of 450 or 500 pages going on, especially in the middle of all the intrigue and inquiry? You're like, how the hell did they pick that one out? Absolutely.
Well, I take
exactly
it as a tribute that clearly people are reading quite intensively, right? They're really picking up things. They're not just flicking through the book. And also that people really, I hope, you know, identify with this girl and what happened to her, and really do want to see justice done for her, so much so that they're trying throughout the book to solve the crime themselves. Now, I give one version of what I think happened, based on a lot of lost documents that I managed to find in the British government archives in London. And some people have sort of added to that. Some people have said, well, have you considered this theory? Have you considered that theory and everything? And I'm just amazed at the inventiveness of people, and also their attention to detail, because, you know, the advantage that my colleagues that write crime fiction have is that they can sort of tidy up all the loose ends. When you do a true crime story, when you recreate a real investigation, there are loose ends, and you can't tidy them up. And I'm sure that in real life, any detective will tell you that there's always loose ends in an investigation. Even when they get their man or their woman, there are still loose ends. And, you know, people are fascinated by these loose ends as well. They're fascinated by the little false trails, the little scandals that, you know, when a murder investigation happens anywhere, it completely lifts the lid off of everything. And all the secrets, all the skeletons come out of the cupboard in an investigation, because, you know, no stone can be left unturned, as they say. But it does mean that at the end of it, there are little bits and pieces where you know, little questions where we don't always have the answers. And that can, I think, to a lot of people who read a lot of very neat crime fiction, sometimes that can seem a little bit scrappy. But I think that's just how life is, you know.
Yeah, and I want to remind everybody, again, we are speaking here with author Paul French, and the book is Midnight in Peking. The website is midnightinpeking.com. One thing I want to try to understand is, when you say, since the crime is unsolved, how do those cold cases get handled in China compared to European, you know, English and United States? Is it something that they put away after so many years and say it's just not going to happen, or do they kind of just, maybe like a detective decides, hey, let's go back and look at it. Does anything like that happen, or do they kind of treat it the same way? How does that kind of work out? Is this ever going to get solved? Probably never, right?
No, well, you know, John, I'm going to argue I solved it, because I'll tell you what happened. The detectives investigated,
like
a British detective and a Chinese detective. And then in July 1937, the Japanese finally invaded China and took Peking. So both the detectives had to disappear very quickly so that the Japanese couldn't get them, right? So that was the case ended. But of course, although China was at war with Japan, at that time, the British and the Americans could still walk around and operate to a certain extent. Because, you know, between that period, between July 1937 and, of course, then the next great date, which is December 8th, 1941, and Pearl Harbor. And, of course, on December the 8th, immediately after Pearl Harbor, Britain and America declare war on Japan, and all British and American nationals in China are rounded up and put into Japanese prisoner of war camps for the rest of the war. Now, in that period between July 37 and December 1941, Pamela's father spent all of his money and all of his time and all of his effort to do a private investigation to try and solve the murder of his daughter. And just before Pearl Harbor, he sent all of his findings, all typed up, to London. And it took 2 years for these documents to get to London because of the disruption of the sea lanes during the war. And when they got to London, nobody had time to look at them. It was still the Blitz. We still had the small matter of defeating Hitler to get on with. And it was put in a drawer in the archives, and it was forgotten about. Of course, 1945, the war is over. China goes into the civil war between the nationalists and the communists. In 1949, Chiang Kai-shek goes to Taiwan. Chairman Mao takes over. The so-called bamboo curtain comes down. We have no access to China after that anymore. In Britain, it also got forgotten about, and it just got put in the National Archives and then sent away. And it was when I was in the archives looking through all the paperwork from the British Embassy in Beijing during that time that I came across this document. And when I cross-referenced the private investigation that her father did with what the police had learnt at the time, what the diplomats had learnt at the time, what had been in the newspapers, what people were able to tell me of that time, I think that her father really did solve it. It's just that he unfortunately died, and those documents just got lost in the system.
Fascinating. Fascinating. I mean, Paul, I'll tell you, the time has just run out, and I could go on and on and on, but I know that you have an event going on at 1 o'clock, and I just want to thank you so much for coming on and sharing this with us, because this is just fascinating stuff.
Thank you so much. Yeah, we're at Politics and Prose, which looks like a lovely bookshop. I'm really excited to be going there today.
Well, have a great time. I'm glad. Hopefully the weather's good for you, and enjoy the tour of the U.S. you got coming up here, and we look forward to seeing your next one. So hopefully you stay in touch with us, and we can have you back on again when you decide to explore some more either Chinese lore or anything else that you're starting to write in the thriller category.
Thanks, John. It's been fun.
All right. You have a good day, Paul, and enjoy yourself.
Cheers, mate.
Okay, everybody. Again, that was author Paul French, and his book is MidnightInPeking.com, or Midnight in Peking, and the website is MidnightInPeking.com. You just heard him from him. Go check out this book. Fascinating details, especially when you have a true crime story like this, and put in 100% of everything is accurate and true, according to Paul, and that is what makes the book just that much more better, because you know what? Sometimes the truth is stranger than fiction, and that's going to lead us into our next segment. But first, we are going to right now take a quick break. We're going to be back with our next guest, Donald Allen Kirch, and we're going to play for you our first audio clip of the day, which is called Rabbit in the Moon by Deborah and Joel Chelan. So listen to this, please.
This is a clip from the audio version of the award-winning thriller Rabbit in the Moon by Deborah and Joel Schlien, produced by Spoken Word, Inc., 1989.
Xi'an, China. From his window in the Shaanxi Provincial People's Hospital, Nifu Cheng could barely make out Xingqing Park on the eastern outskirts of the city. When he was first sent to Xi'an some 34 years ago, he spent many hours strolling among the trees and flowers that grew on the ancient site. Once the official residence of the Tang Dynasty, Xingqing's palace's 123 acres had long ago been replaced by an art gallery, reading room, tea house, small lake, and children's playground. Nifu had loved coming there. At first it was simply to drink in the beauty, to read and think among the singing cicada. There were great possibilities then, and his heart was filled with hope. In recent years, he'd sought the shelter of the park for different reasons. The peace he found there helped to drive away his growing sadness. But at age 75, he was now locked inside the Xi'an Institute, deprived of even the park's small pleasure. He turned to catch the cool winter breeze and was just able to discern the edges of the buildings that made up Jiaotong University. Off and on over the past 30 years, he'd taught science and medicine there, reveling in the exchange of ideas with eager young men and women hungry for knowledge. And for over 30 years he'd managed to keep his longevity research a secret. Damn Dr. Tseng. Too bad he'd taken over the institute. Too bad he'd understood the implications of Nifu's work. And too bad, like a good puppet of the party, Tseng had been only too eager to ingratiate himself with the elders. Well, at least Nifu had had the foresight to hide his research notes where no one would find them. Not even the torture he'd endured had loosened his tongue. Nifu thought he caught the voices of some young students outside. How he missed them! To Nifu, they were China's most precious resource, the hope for his country's future. To old men like General Tong and his fellow Long Marchers, this young generation was the single greatest threat to the party's existence. Fear of losing power had made Nifu their prisoner. He would be their salvation, hopefully producing a potion to literally cheat death, one that would enable them to live long enough to suppress this young generation, as they themselves had been suppressed over 40 years before. Tears came to Nifu's eyes as he considered the futility of his life.
Glamour, celebrity, and murder. Whether you're looking for mystery or suspense, you'll find it all at Thriller Fest. Open to readers, aspiring writers, and published authors. Learn craft, meet top thriller writers, and enjoy New York City July 11th through the 14th. Jack Higgins, R.L. Stine, Lee Child, Karen Slaughter, Catherine Coulter, Richard North Patterson, John Sanford, Ann Rule, and more. Join them this summer. Find out more at www.thrillerfest.com.
And just to let everybody know, we are back here from our lunch break, but Thriller Fest special pricing ends this weekend. We just received an email from Doug Lyle, who is on the committee for Thriller Fest. So if that's something that you're interested in, and I want to tell everybody, I recommend every author and fan to at least attend one Thriller Fest, especially if you're an author to attend Craft Fest. Get your butt over there and learn from the greatest right now that are writing in the thriller industry today, if that's the genre you're writing, whether it's suspense, mystery, thriller, horror. But the great thing about it, even if you're not writing in that genre, still get your butt over there, because a book is a book. And this is what I'm going to say. No matter what genre you're writing, you still have to follow, whether it's simple rules about your characters, whether you're writing a romantic book, whether you're writing a drama like a Nicholas Sparks or something to that, you still have to have the same kind of format. It just doesn't have to be murder and intrigue and things like that. So get your butt to Thriller Fest and learn from the best of the best right in front of you, sitting in a classroom of maybe 40 people. Ask any questions you want. Talk to them anytime you want. So check out Thriller Fest and check out the ITW, especially if you are a thriller writer author. You can join ITW for free, people. It's free promotion. And that's one other thing I'm going to say. I get emails all the time. All the time people email and say, oh, how do I market my book? What can I do? Blah, 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 blah. Stop crying and start looking. Because, first of all, Suspense Radio, like we just did, would play your audio clip for free on the radio show. You just have to send it in to us, and we'll play it for you. The other thing, you have ITW, if you're a thriller author and suspense writer, and you've written a book with one of their approved publishers, and they have hundreds of them, you can join for free, for free. So there's tons of places to go out and find. You just have to go do it. All right, enough of my rant. Because now we're going to bring on our next guest and contributor to Suspense Magazine, good friend of ours, Donald Alan Kirch, who writes the Stranger Than Fiction series for us in the magazine, but has done many other things in books. And his recent was, he has Still Waters coming, his Manchester House out. So, Donald, how you doing?
I'm doing great, John. How are you this morning?
Fabulous. I want to remind you, too, your website, Donald Allen, A-L-L-E-N, Kirch, K-I-R-C-H.com, is the website to find out all the stuff that's going on in your world. So, up update us a little bit on what's happening, because Manchester House was the last book that we talked to you about, and what's been going on since then? What have you been writing? What have you been doing?
Well, I just came out with a new fantasy series called The Known World Chronicles. I have two books that just came out. The first book was called The Misadventures of Karan the Knight, and the second book that just recently came out is called The Lurker War. And basically, it has elements of science fiction, fantasy, horror, and a little love story here and there. And I just like the character, because the character himself, I feel so sorry for him. He gets cursed by a witch, and he gets turned from a man into a woman, and he has to go through all these weird juxtaposition things in his life with the big change. And he's got to deal with dragons, elves, dwarves, people trying to kill him, vampires. And it's a pretty exciting series. I like it. And
wow.
I also it was interesting. And I got a third book that's going to be coming out, which will be the end of that trilogy, which will be coming out sometime next year. And I'm looking forward to that. I mean, I have a lot of people that keep, you know, they look at me when they're reading this, and I'm watching them when they're reading the book, and they're looking over the book, and they're staring at me because they can't believe that I would write that stuff. And it's pretty interesting. I like it.
You know, and out of all those things that you mentioned with the vampires and the dragons and everything else like that, I think the scariest part was being turned from a man into a woman. That would be my
guess. It's like, well, after you scream for about 30 minutes, then you got to worry about wardrobe, the way people treat you, how you treat yourself, and all that stuff. But I also have a historical novel that will be coming out pretty soon called Selznick's Folly, which is a fictional account. It's a fictional account on the making of Gone with the Wind.
Oh, now how did you get involved with something like that? Because when you write for the article, you write our article, Stranger Than Fiction, in the magazine, and you know, you come up with such fascinating topics of this and that. what made you think of Gone with the Wind?
Well, I love history. I'm a big history fan. In fact, when your former guest was on, I was listening to it, and I'm going, oh, my God, I got to read this. It sounds great.
Yeah.
History just has a way of just grabbing my curiosity. All the coulda, wouldas, and shouldas, and the things that people do. I mean, we take it for granted that, you know, the movie Gone with the Wind is a classic, and that when it was a masterpiece, it is a masterpiece. But back in the day, the press, they didn't think that the movie would work. In fact, they labeled it Selznick's Folly. They thought the movie was going to be a flop, just like before James Cameron released Titanic. They thought it was going to be a flop because nobody can spend that much money on a movie and expect it to be make a profit, because back in the 1930s, an average motion picture cost anywhere from $25,000 to $40,000 tops to make. Gone with the Wind cost $3 million, and that was in 1938 dollars.
So that's probably 250 million today, probably.
Probably even more. I mean, but
that's like John Carter money.
But I like John Carter. I mean, besides what the critics said, I liked it. I read the books when I was young, and I liked the movie. I thought the movie was good. But
yeah, that's one movie. I actually never read the books. I didn't see the movie. I had no idea, really, who the guy even was. So it was kind of a shock when it came out. And then I'm one of those people that I actually do kind of read reviews from the experts, and I read it more from the fans. And I think they said they found it entertaining, but it just wasn't one that kind of piqued me to say, yeah, I'm going to go out and spend my $15 to go see it. I think it's just one I'm just going to wait and see, probably on the DVD when it comes out.
Well, when it comes out, watch it. You will not be disappointed. But,
And so, I mean, and that's all the stuff that you have going on, and the history and everything else that you're involved in. But the Gone with the Wind is definitely a little different. I don't know if I – how are you going to spin it, I guess? I'm trying to sit here and think, you just bring it on. So how are you going to spin it? How are you going to do it?
The way that I wrote it up was that this is back in the old Hollywood. I mean, it was run by a system back then, and all of a sudden here comes this independent upstart that thinks he actually buys, like, the bestseller of his era. I mean, it was Gone with the Wind. Back then it sold more books than the Bible. And everybody was just waiting for this guy to fall on his butt. They wanted him to go bankrupt. They wanted Selznick International Pictures to go the way of the dodo, and they all wanted to just send a message, you can't do this, you have to come to us, the Hollywood system, to make a movie. And he also had the unfortunate happenstance of being the son-in-law of Louis B. Mayer. And everybody said, this guy, he's gonna mess up real bad, because he always had this big, overpowering, I mean, Louis B. Mayer, he was like one of the M's in MGM. I mean, he couldn't do anything without that shadow falling on his world. And he was an independent, and the population was demanding that Red Butler be played by Clark Gable, who was at that time the number one actor at MGM. And MGM was never in the habit of loaning out its actors. And he was an independent, and he had to go to his father-in-law with hat in hand and practically beg him. I mean, can I have Clark Gable?
Wow. And it's funny today, isn't it? Because actors aren't really owned by the studio. They're kind of independent. So any studio can kind of hire any actor. But back then, you were part of the studio. That was the whole pull for the studio.
Yeah, you back then, John Wayne, Henry Fonda, Clark Gable, Vivien Leigh, you were property. You were something that was owned by the studio. You were a product they were selling.
Yeah, you were a commodity. You were their commodity. It wasn't the story. They wanted the actor more than they wanted the story, and they felt that if they had the actors as staples, they could kind of put Clark Gable in anything, and it would sell, and it typically did. So they kind of worked that business model for a while until, finally it got all cracked.
Yeah. And
you might be interested to know, I don't know if we told you this, but Eric Larson, who wrote Thunderstruck and Devil in the White City and The New and Garden and the Beast. Yeah, we interviewed him for the magazine. He's going to be in May. So I don't know if you've read his book.
Great.
So it was fun to get Devil in the White City.
Devil in the White City is a masterpiece. Yeah.
Your writing kind of reminds me of, about like an Eric Larson, that just like in your enthusiasm and how you kind of do everything, it's kind of like that kind of genre.
Oh, wow.
That's the kind of fan that would love your work as somebody like that.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Yeah. I appreciate that. When I write a book, when I'm getting into it, I'm also the reader. I that sounds weird, but when I'm writing it, I like to write it in a way that I would like to read a novel. I mean, it's there are times when I'm writing, I will sort of like turn myself off, and later when I go back and proofread, I'm reading what I wrote, and I'm going, oh, I wrote this, cool. it's funny. It's an interesting world that writers are in.
Well, yeah, and that's the one thing I've put this out there a couple times. I mean, of course, it is our original TV show, which we're doing, which is, Welcome to Green Lake, or Green Lake, whatever you want to call it. And it's been delayed because we were trying to get it done, but now you're on board, and a lot of people might not know that you and I are now going to be the ones that are writing this story, and we're having a lot of fun doing it, and it's just something that, it's just another kind of exploration of the world of writing and everything else, because I don't think it's ever been done before. I think that we're going to be kind of, hopefully, some trendsetters and what's going to happen on what to do with your blog or just different kinds of things of writing on how the TV show is going to go, and who knows?
Yes, it shows a lot of good possibilities. I mean,
I
love the concept.
Aren't we crazy? We're crazy.
Well, you have to be. You have to be. I mean, we live in fiction. I mean, same people don't live in fiction.
And sometimes it's even more fun to live in fiction than in the real world. Anyway, I'm not gonna lie. I'm not gonna lie on that.
Yeah. I mean, reality is as crazy as a soup sandwich.
Yeah, it is. So, but what do you have coming up? I guess Stranger Than Fiction. Where do you write? I mean, where else can people find you besides your website, DonaldAllenKirch.com? What other things do you do? Because I know that you kind of You kind of write blogs and things around from different things and different people. Where else can maybe people find out stuff that's going on and anything?
Well, they can always go to my my website. I have a blog on there, and I do little muses on there. Goodreads.com, I do some stuff on there. I write little short stories and things on there for people. I just like to keep people up to date on stuff, and one of my joys right now is writing the article Stranger Than Fiction, because that gives me a chance to do one of the things that I loved to do as a child. I was always one of these kids that would question things, and from my childhood there was a television series called In Search Of that was hosted by Leonard Nimoy, and each week they would do things like In Search Of Bigfoot, In Search Of UFOs, In Search Of Monsters and stuff, and that just got my imagination going, and that's one of the things that I like contributing to with Stranger Than Fiction, because it can be, each month, it can be about anything. And there are times when I have so many ideas in my mind that I have to actually, you know, throw 90% of it, you know, back for another month or something like that, because I just like questioning things. To me, there's more to the world than just 2 + 2 = 4. Sometimes it does come out to 5, and that's the mystery of the thing.
Well, I happen to be a subscriber, and I really have no idea how this happened, but I happen to be a subscriber to Maxim magazine, and they just send it to me. I have no idea. But in this edition of Maxim, and quite frankly, I kind of go through and maybe read some of the stuff. It just doesn't interest me really in a magazine. But this month's issue of Maxim magazine actually has a very cool article about Amityville Horror, and I know that you wrote something about that. In fact, in like Manchester House, heck, the cover, the thing on the cover is almost like a beaten down Amityville Horror house.
Yes.
But
yes,
the guy on there, it's one of those fascinating mysteries of, did the Lutzes actually have something happen to them? Was it all staged? Did they not? Was there something going on? Is everything can be explained? Because the guy who wrote this, Robert Katzenbach, I believe is what his name is, who kind of did a little mini-series and a little thing over it. He basically claims that the Lutzes were basically Nutses and nothing happened. And also that the guy, the killer, Robert DeVincio or DeFeo. DeFeo. That he did not work alone. That he had help. So
yeah,
that might
I think
be something to kind of look at.
Yeah, I think I when I was doing the investigation for that, I came across some evidence that DeFeo, they believe, they can't substantiate it. They believe that
because
he had his older sister help.
Yeah, because he confessed to everything on his own.
He changes his story with the weather, but a lot of people believe that his older sister helped him because they wanted to share the insurance money that they would have gotten from their parents' death.
Okay, and that was the main thing, too, was that he kind of put in there that she went a little wacko and killed the little kids when she wasn't supposed to or something to that effect, and she's the one who kind of went off crazy and did those kinds of things, and that the Lutzes really had nothing happen to them, that this was not the work of some extraterrestrial evilness of the house, that it was literally just a couple kids with some help trying to get, like, kind of like the Menendez brothers.
Yeah. When it comes to stories like this, that when you're dealing with a house that's dripping with evil kind of thing and stuff, when I think of that stuff, two thoughts come to mind. That one is that evil does exist, and the other thought is that there's always somebody out there that's trying to make a movie. So
right.
It's like it's kind of hard nowadays. When I was a kid, I believed that stuff. I mean, you could tell me there was a Santa Claus, and I believed you. I'm kind of skeptical now, but still, I love the mystery of the thing. Like,
are you saying there's no Santa?
No, I didn't say that. I can't say that. If I said that, the elf mafia would be after me.
Okay, I'm just making sure you didn't actually say that. Okay, go ahead.
No, but I like mystery. The number one thing that I like about the mystery is the why. I mean, when you get past the evil and all that, it's like, why did they do it? That's the, I hate to say, fun part for something involving a murder and stuff like, but that's the fun part, trying to figure out the why and whatever it is.
And do you really think, I always thought that the Lutzes were Nutses and that nothing ever happened to them. And when you actually look at it, I guess George Lutz actually had like a 90% stake in the Amityville Horror LLC or something to that effect, and it just seemed like it was just all for money, and it worked. I mean, he pulled off a very great con.
Well, yeah, and he also had help with the great talent of Jay Anson, who actually wrote the book, The Amityville Horror.
Right.
I mean, the book itself, when you get past all the speculation and the accusations of flim-flam and all that, the book is actually a really good, scary, old-fashioned haunted house story. And just for the sake of the story alone, it's enjoyable. But when you get to the based on the true story kind of thing, that's when people start going, I don't know about that, maybe later.
Right, and that's kind of the thing when you're talking here, and reminding everybody, we're talking here with author Donald Alan Kirch, and donaldalankirch.com is his website, and all the things that he writes, Stranger Than Fiction and Manchester House and a lot of the other things that he has going on. So when, I guess the one thing is that how do you decide when you're writing kind of like an Amityville Horror, that what kind of triggers it when readers or researchers are going through that you are like, this just doesn't all make sense to me?
Well, like when I wrote Manchester House, originally I was just going to write a nice, you know, good old-fashioned haunted house story, but I was fortunate enough to get with some local ghost hunters that went to a haunted house down in, you know, where I live near Atchison, Kansas, and I was actually attacked by a ghost.
Really?
And yes, either that or it was the best case of psychosomatic trauma I've ever encountered. But
right.
I was actually attacked by a ghost. We went into a house called the Sally House, and there's supposed to be a spirit there of a little girl who doesn't like men and will attack them. And
she's modern.
Well, I model my characters after people that I know or people that I've encountered in my life. And I was just following these ghost hunters, and I was just getting the feel of them. And just as I was getting ready to write in my notebook and head down a flight of stairs, there was like an old Victorian staircase. I felt a pair of very adult hands grab me by the shoulders, and a pair of very childlike hands grabbed me by the ankles. And the hands on my shoulders pushed, and the hands on my ankles pulled. And if it hadn't been for my instinct to put both hands against the railing and the wall going down the stairs, I would have flipped, you know, butt over tea kettle down this long Victorian staircase and could have possibly broke my neck.
That would have been cool.
Breaking my neck, Bart.
Yeah, not the breaking the neck, but... Man, that would have been neat, because I would love to be able to encounter a ghost like that. Just any, maybe not like that, but I want to encounter some kind of ghost. I've gone to different places and I've really never encountered. I've had chilly feelings, but I think that just might be more of my mind. Hopefully, something is happening, and I would just.
It actually made me a believer. It made me a believer. In fact, I go up to skeptics, and I have a three-part question that I ask them, you know, as far as, you know, about the ghost equation. I usually ask them, first question I ask them is, do you believe in God? If they answer yes, I say, okay, now, do you believe in angels? If they answer that one yes, I say, okay, now, if you believe in God, and if you do believe in angels, how can you not believe in ghosts?
Correct. That's true. It's just... whatever faith they choose to have at that time, for some people, it's like, oh, well, that can't be true, that can't be true. And that's the other thing I always say, if you believe in God, you have to believe in the devil. You don't have to agree with him, but you have to believe that he's there. And if you believe that he's there and you believe that there's evil spirits and demons and things like that, then you have to think that there's some kind of supernatural things that are going on. You just can't say that they're not there. Whether you
Absolutely.
Believe where they come from, you just have to believe that they're there. I mean, that's
Absolutely.
Just the biggest thing.
And
yeah,
in
that was
my
cracking
world,
up. To...
In my world of horror, unlike most people when they write, they always let the monster gets destroyed and everyone lives happily ever after and it fades to black. In my world of horror, the evil itself is never really completely destroyed. Because if evil could be so easily destroyed, good wouldn't fear it so much.
True.
That's the kind of flavor of evil that I like to write about.
So we got about a minute left. I want you to tell me which historical mystery, if you could solve for yourself and finally have the answer, which one would it be? Which one eludes you the most to want to know the answer to?
I would like to know if the rumor of King Tut's curse and the finding of a plaque at his tomb, if it was actually true or if it was just a rumor.
That's what you'd want to go back and find out. And have you found anything to the case? Have you read or had anything that might sway you in any direction?
No, just the unfortunate happenstance of people dying around the discovery of the tomb itself. But there was supposed to have been a plaque or some kind of carving that was a curse that told people if they entered his tomb, they would die. And then afterwards it was supposed to have disappeared. And I just want to know, I would like to know if that was actually true or if it was just something created as a press, you know, story, yeah. A hook to get people interested.
Right. Well, Donald, I want to thank you so much for coming on. It's always a pleasure to talk to you on the air. Of course, we talk many times off the air and everything else.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just fabulous to be able to. And we're going to get together and finish this damn Green Lake, and we're going to keep it going, and it's going to be great, and we can't wait to see what else is coming out from you. And so thank you so much again for joining us, and you have a great
one. No problem.
Thank
you, my friend.
All right, enjoy. All right, bye, Donald. So again, everybody, Donald Alan Kirch writes many different things, like you said, heard a lot of different historical, a lot of things that are going on, stranger than fiction, kind of explores the psyche of the mind to let you go a little bit beyond the normal horror thriller and really kind of make you sit and think and maybe open your mind up to kind of a whole new world about what's going on. And that's just what's fascinating. So we're going to come out here now and we're going to play our next book clip to our next guest. Robert Bennett is going to be on after that. And this clip is coming from, it's called Blood is Pretty. It's by Stephen Paul Mavia. And check this out and then we'll be right back.
This is from Blood is Pretty, The First Fixer Adventure, by Stephen Paul Leva. You have not yet found a cinematographer who has done you justice. Not at all startled by my statement, Anne Isley turned her head and looked at me. Are you the man Norton said he would send? I am. Please sit down. The bench is only a little damp. I sat and out of habit made a quick survey of the area. We were alone except for a middle-aged woman with the look of a national public radio listener doing Tai Chi on the bank of the stream. You're right, of course. I've never liked myself on the screen, visually. I've been relatively happy with my performances. I can't wait to get an A-list cinematographer. Do you have a name? Those who become associated with me tend to call me Fixer. Fixer? Why? I fix things. Not toasters and TVs, I take it. That's correct. It's situations, not appliances, I'm good at. Well, I have a situation I need fixed. Tell me about it. Can we walk? I wouldn't want to disturb her serenity. She said, referring to Miss Tai Chi. When she stood up, I could see her beauty in its totality. Not just her face, which was the most perfect face I had ever seen, with everything correctly proportioned over a jawline that was poetry. Her nose was as perfectly formed as Copernicus's universe. Her lips were full and sensual, but not overblown and pouting, and her complexion was clear and luminous. It was probably the long winters in South Dakota that allowed little sun in to do its damaging worse. Here, where the sun was but one of many things that could sting you, she obviously maintained her skin's protection through an admirable intelligence. Intelligence also defined her eyes, which were a unique and deep aquamarine. It was a cool intelligence, but intelligence nonetheless. All of this was framed by gold blonde hair that fell down the sides of her face in thick, meaningful waves. But, as I said, it was not just her face. It was the full effect of her that really stunned. She wore a baggy sports jacket, but open, allowing a view. Her breasts were the size and shape that made a man think not just of sex, but of nurturing. Her waist cried for the clasp of your hands, and her long legs talked of nights entwined in your own. Did she work out to achieve this? Or was she just a case of perfect aesthetics? Could I fall in love with her? Every man asks himself this question when he is face to face with daunting beauty. I could have answered this one in a flash, but I begged myself for more time to think about it. We left the tea house and walked on the blacktop path towards the center of the gardens, passing the rosarium and entering into a grove of California live oaks, the tree that dominates the gardens. Dozens of squirrels darted across the grounds from tree trunk to tree trunk, and above jumped from one rough, wavy branch to another. I come from South Dakota, a traditional middle American town, town of values. Values are very big right now. Don't mock me. The flash of her anger was stunning. I'm sorry if you took it that way. Are you going to take me seriously? She challenged. Yes, I promise.
So again, everybody, that was a clip from the book Blood is Pretty by Stephen Paul LaVia. And you can go online and find out a lot more about Stephen that you want. Our first clip, again, was Rabbit in the Moon by Deborah and Joel Chelan. And if you want to hear your audio clip on the air, all you have to do is simply email editor@suspensemagazine.com, 2 to 3 minute audio clip, and we will get it on in a future show. It's free marketing. Again, stop complaining about marketing and start doing something about it. And this is just one of the ways that Suspense Radio is trying to help and magazine trying to help you guys out to sell more books and to get more fans. And speaking here, now we're going to go to our next guest. And his website, his name is Robert Bennett, and his website is enablingwords.com. His latest book is Blind Traveler's Blues. His previous one was Blind Traveler, Down a Dark River, and we want to welcome Robert to the show. So, Robert, thank you so much for joining us. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor.
Thank you. And Blind Traveler's Blues, like we just said, is your latest book. And tell a little bit about the book, because it's a Douglas, and I'm gonna mess it up. Is it Abeldan?
That's exactly right.
Abeldan.
You pronounced it perfectly. Yes.
So that's kind of the main character. So tell a little bit about the book here, and give a little bit of insight about Blind Traveler's Blues.
Well, I'll give you some background of the series first. Blind Traveler Down the Dark River, as you said, was my first book, and it's the story of Douglas Abeldan, who is a blind man who was the victim of an accidental drive-by shooting some years ago. The story takes place in the year 2021, and I came about it because I had written an article about a device that would allow a blind person to navigate the world using GPS technology and virtual sound technology. And so I took that and I threw it into the future so the technology was solid, and so that I could play with it a bit. Mm-hmm. And so that's who this character is. And he literally stumbles on murders that are about to take place. And so the first book was about one murder that took place. And the second book is more of him going basically on a field trip. He's going on a vacation to Chicago. He meets a woman who is an agricultural pathologist going to Chicago for a meeting about a plague that is affecting the world's corn crop. And without giving away too many spoilers, eventually he has to solve her murder.
So So the one thing that I find in it, and what you mentioned is I want you to expand a little bit about, is that you said he can see it before it happens. He kind of sees what's going on before it happens. What kind of dynamic is that?
It's not that he sees what happens beforehand. He kind of sort of stumbles on the murder before it happens. In other words, I'll give you an example from the first book.
Okay.
The first book, what happened was he was on a street corner and he was trying to navigate himself to work, and he ended up being someplace that he wasn't supposed to be. In other words, his device malfunctioned, and so instead of telling him where he was, it told him someplace that he was a few blocks away from where he should be. And the device allowed him to, quote-unquote, see a murder about to happen.
Ah, so he kind of had a really whacked-out map quest.
Pretty much, yes. you know how MapQuest often tells you to go places that it thinks are shortcuts but really aren't?
Right, right.
Okay. Well, this is basically what happened in the first
place. I gotcha. And the one thing, too, is that your book is set also in 2021.
Yes.
Now, was there a reason why you wanted to set this in the future? Was there something behind that?
Well, two things. Number one, as I said, I wanted this technology to be firm and solid and something I could play with.
Okay.
And it's real technology that was put on the market a couple years ago, and I had spoken to the inventor of it. And actually, after the book came out, the first book came out, I sent the book to him, and he said this was exactly where he wanted the technology to go in the future.
Oh, so, okay, I gotcha.
Which was a really cool thing to happen, and I was very honored by what he said. And so that was one of the reasons that I did it. The other reason that I did it was that at the time that I wrote the first book, the world seemed to be going through an uptick in earthquake activity.
Okay.
And so I figured that I wanted to set up a world where that uptick would continue and continue and continue, and so that it, by the time 2021 happens, there's an awful lot of earthquakes going on a daily basis in places that they never happened before. And so people have to go through different ways of surviving and different ways of adapting.
Now, when you're inside your book, and again, I want to remind everybody that we're speaking here with author Robert Bennett. His website is enablingwords.com. We're talking about his book, Blind Traveler's Blues, which is involving your character, Douglas Abeldan, and he's blind. And so the one thing that you have to have something in today, it's almost like, you know, a little bit different than the normal kind of detective. And so when you made him blind, that kind of was like your way of kind of separating him apart from the normal detective that is written in thriller books today. And is that something that you thought about? Was the handicap, I guess you want to say, was that the important part behind creating your character, Douglas?
Well, let me put it to you this way. For 20 years, I've been a journalist writing about issues of disability. And so I've written about everything from blindness to paraplegia. Trying to show a character who was blind, but somebody who was powerful and was able to get through his life and adapt and do his own thing was very important to me.
Okay. And that's kind of the thing that I like to know, is that it, kind of the thought process that an author has in creating not only your main character, but the one thing that you probably get a lot of emails of is the secondary characters that you have in your book. And is there one particular that stands out here in this book that you either were surprised on how he came out or she came out, and surprised about the response that you get from fans going, you know, why did they pick this character? Is there someone in there that kind of did that for you?
Well, I'm always surprised at the things that readers come up with.
I'm still surprised. They surprise me every damn day.
What readers come up with, and also what reviewers come up with. Every time I get a new review, the reviewer will pick on something that somebody else has not picked up on. I find that fascinating, and I love it.
When you kind of got into this business, and a lot of people, you know, might not know too, is that when you get a review, whether it was good or bad, what was kind of the first thing that you kind of took away from it as, you know, as an author that was kind of new and going out into the world with this kind of stuff? Putting yourself out there, I guess you want to say.
Well, what first struck me was, holy cow, I'm an author. You know, and people are going to be reading my stuff. And that strikes me every day, and I'm thrilled by it and amazed at it. And what I also came to understand over time, and I tell people this all the time, that I don't believe in the term fiction. I believe that everything comes from who a person is and where they come from and their interactions with their own life.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so that I base my stories and my characters and so forth on something that has happened to me with somebody who I've spoken to, or things like that. And so I find it really interesting when a reader or a reviewer will question me about that, or will make a comment about that. You know, where do I come up with characters? How do I do that? And I think that all authors are questioned about that. You know, how do you come up with a scenario? How do you know this? My mother is constantly amazed at all the technology that I throw into the books, or the archaeological stuff that I throw into the books, and she wonders where I get this information from. And the truth of the matter is, I do an awful lot of research, as all authors do. You know, so I learn a lot.
Right, right.
Which is one of the things I truly love about writing, both nonfiction and fiction, is that we as authors learn an awful lot. And it's a constant process.
Oh, absolutely. It is definitely it's a lot of it is a labor of love. When you're doing a lot of research and you're coming up with roadblocks after roadblocks, to break through onto that is very difficult. And then the other thing is, sometimes you have so much research, it's like, how do you pare this down instead of writing a dictionary to kind of pick out the things that you feel that are going to be the most important and the most entertaining to a book? And that's another thing that you kind of have to navigate through, and that's before you've even put a word on the page.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because when I was doing research for the second book, and I had to come up with a means for the murders to occur, you know, how the murderer was going to do the murders.
Mm-hmm.
And so I came up with the concept of poisoning, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to do research on poisons and how they interacted with the body. And there was an awful lot of stuff out there about poisons. And you have to willow it down. You have to narrow down how much you're going to tell the reader, because you don't want to get boring.
Right. You don't want to do what I always tell people, you don't want to do a Tom Clancy by basically going and saying way too much to where people just kind of glaze it over. You just want
sure.
to give them you want to give them enough so they know that you're doing your homework, and then that now they understand it, but not so much to where they're just like, all right, let's just move it on a little bit here.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
And that's the difficult part that you have.
It's very hard to decide what is salient and what isn't, you know, and what a reader is going to find interesting and what a reader is not going to find interesting. And the trouble is that you've got many different kinds of readers. You know, you've got readers who are interested in the technology, and so you want to throw a bit of that in. You've got readers who are interested in the method of murder, so you want to throw a bit of that in. And so instead of coming up with a tome that is several thousand pages long, which a lot of writers do as their first draft, you know, you have to narrow it down and give everybody a taste.
And I want to remind everybody here, we are speaking with author Robert Bennett. His website is enablingwords.com. His series from Douglas Abeldan, the second book here is Blind Traveler's Blues, and the first book was Blind Traveler Down a Dark River. And the one thing that you do also that a lot of authors today have to do, and we talked a little bit about this, was the whole, you know, welcome to the social media. But when you check out your events and things that you have done in the past, you've done a lot of radio, you've done a lot of blogs for guest blogs and things like that. When you first decided, you know, this is what you have to do and put yourself out there, was there a lot of anxiety to that? Because, I say a lot of authors, they don't really know which way to go. And how much anxiety did you have going onto those sites and basically having to put yourself out there in front of people, which is, you know, it's kind of a difficult thing if you've never done it before?
Well, two things. Number one, when I wrote the first book several years ago, it was like eight or nine years ago at this point, a lot of the social media stuff did not exist yet.
Right.
Okay. So that I still had to find a way to put myself out there, radio or stand up and do book readings, that kind of thing. Now, I'm not a shy person, and I know that, you know, you have to promote yourself, but it was still a steep learning curve to try to figure out how to go about promoting myself and not looking like an idiot, if you will, you know, and not sounding as if you don't know what you're talking about.
Right, because that's a good way for fans to not read your book.
That's exactly right. You know, you don't want to sound cocky, but on the other hand, you don't want to sound misinformed either, if you will, you know. So that you have to kind of sort of find a balance between the two. And like I said, I've done an awful lot of these radio interviews. I've done an awful lot of blogs, etc. And I absolutely love doing them. I'm probably very different than a lot of my fellow authors in that I absolutely love talking to people like you because I love getting myself out there. And to tell you the truth, I love the questions that I get asked because it makes me think.
And that's one of the and you're probably getting new questions all the time when people email you and they ask you different things or you're on the road and you've different blogs, and that is kind of entertaining that you are being able to see kind of how the interviewer, like myself, kind of how we think, because then that gives you an idea of almost kind of how the world is going on with fans and things like that, because it's like this is what people might be interested in.
Well, it's like I said before, people are interested in so many different things that it's difficult to keep up sometimes. But I do find that the questions that I get asked, both by you and other radio interviewers and by even the bloggers, I find those to be fascinating. And they really make me think about how I want to present my characters and how I want to present myself.
Just off the top of your head, if you can ever think back, what's kind of the one thing that when you ever got emailed a question or a comment, which one kind of stands out in your head almost like, you know, you never would have thought that this question would have ever been asked, and you were just kind of shocked that you kind of got it?
I'll tell you a funny thing. My first book came out, and I had a couple of women readers who were disappointed that I didn't have a love interest in my book.
Okay.
Okay. And frankly, I didn't think that it was necessary. But I have since come to understand that there's going to be many different kinds of readers. Some of them are going to be female. And female readers, a lot of them, and even some male readers, want that kind of social interaction between characters. And at the beginning, that bothered me that somebody would ask me about something that I really didn't want to put into the character, you know, that I didn't think was necessary. But over time, I have reevaluated, and I have understood that characters really need to be three-dimensional, and they need to have the all the stuff that you do in the day-to-day real life, you know? Does that
right.
make any sense?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's kind of leads me to another question is, when you're writing, and there's many different kinds of subgenres that kind of fall in with suspense and mystery and thriller, and some people put comedy in there, some people put historical, there's some people put romance in there. Which of those kinds of subgenres underneath the main part of your story do you find the most challenging for yourself to write? You just try to make sure you get it right. Is it romance? Is it comedy? Is it something else? What do you find most challenging to yourself that you actually almost find refreshing that you get to challenge yourself with it?
Oh, there's so many different things, so many different subtitles, sub-subjects that I put in my book. Everything from mystery, which is the main thing, of course, to science fiction, to disability, which is really an important part of my books, to architecture, to, you know, you name it. And it's difficult to figure out exactly what I want to put in, and it's difficult to have to do the research on all of that stuff. So you kind of have to focus on things. You know what I mean?
Right, absolutely.
You have to kind of focus on one or two main things, and the other things kind of fall into place as well.
And is that something when you, yeah, and when you're going forward, because you're going to, you know, you're going to continue on with the series here, so when you've already kind of blocked out and outlined out maybe your next book and maybe the book after that, do you make a conscious effort to kind of change your maybe subgenre a little bit to kind of do the challenging part of yourself and put a little bit different kind of emotion into the books and the characters?
You have to. Because my protagonist, my hero, is blind, I'm going to focus all of my books on his remaining senses. You know,
okay.
For instance, in the first book, he solved the murder by using his hearing. The second book, it's more a matter of his sense of smell. You get my point?
I do.
Okay. So that eventually what's going to happen is that you have to do research on all of these things. Okay. And I did an awful lot of research. I've read a bunch of books about how the senses developed, you know, in the brain, and how
right.
everybody kind of sort of attaches themselves to different senses. You know, we live in a very yeah. visual world. Most people interact with other things, with their world around them and with the people around them through their sense of sight. I couldn't, but through my character, so I had to come up with other ways to do that. I think I just answered your question, but I'm not sure.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I know, that was good. I mean, I get exactly where you're going. And now I'm going to kind of flip gears on you a little bit, and just to kind of know a little bit about, you know, just a little bit beyond, nothing with books, nothing to do with anything. What's on your DVR right now? What shows are you watching on TV? What shows interest you?
That's a good question. I like it. I like shows and I like stories that I have to think about. So that me and my family, we watched the show Ringer, okay, with Sarah Geller. You know,
yes, that's okay. Right, Ringer.
Right, and we love it because we never know where things are going to go next.
And does that give you the inspiration? Does that kind of help you maybe with your writing a little bit? Because it gives you a little bit of different taste, yeah? Okay.
It does. I also watched the show Fringe, which unfortunately I found out is going to be the next season. It's going to be the last season.
It is. They're going to do 12 episodes, and they're going to reach 100, so it'll be in syndication. But at least they brought it back.
Right, exactly. And we've loved that show. And that has helped me a lot in my writing as well, because it's kept me grounded in the science fiction aspect of my stories.
Okay.
Okay.
Well.
And the what if and the alternate reality is really an important focus for that series, and also for mine because my books take place in the future.
Mm-hmm. I gotcha. Well, I'll tell you what, Robert, I mean, we just blew through the time here, and I want to thank you so much for coming on and speaking with us again. Your website, enablingwords.com, and the book is Blind Traveler's Blues, and I want to recommend everybody to go out there and definitely take a look at, you know, what you've been able to create here with your characters and everything that you got going on. Very fascinating stuff, and I want to thank you for joining us.
I would also, I thank you very much for inviting me to the show, and I've had a great time, and it was a lot of fun. I'd also like to direct people to my blog, which is the Blind Traveler's blog.
And they can get that from your website?
They can get that from my website. And basically what I do with the blog is I talk about what it means to have a disability and what life is all about, basically. You know, I talk about my own self.
Give people a little bit about you.
Yeah, I talk about myself and my own experiences because I'm a paraplegic. And I talk about what the world is like for people with disabilities.
Gotcha. And I want to thank you so much for entertaining everybody and giving
you
a little bit more insight.
This has been a lot of fun, and I greatly appreciate it. I've been honored by being on the show. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Robert, and you have a good one.
You too.
All right. Again, everybody, that was Robert Bennett, and the website is enablingwords.com. Go check that out. We're going to be back here with our last segment here, and Andrew Kaplan, the author of the hot new thriller Scorpion Betrayal, has just been released, and I know a lot of people are definitely excited about that. So we're going to give you the opportunity to listen to a friend of ours, CJ West, and his audio clip of his book, The End of Marking Time. So check this out with CJ, and then we'll be right back with Andrew Kaplan.
Hi, this is CJ West, and this clip is from my novel, The End of Marking Time. I stopped at the bedroom door to look back and wonder if I'd ever own a place like this. With an 8th grade education, probably not, especially where I went to school. But for the next 30 minutes, I'd be driving a top-of-the-line Mercedes with a pocket full of cash and plastic. The garage door opened smoothly. I drove out and hit the remote like I lived there. I was pretty full of myself when I made the corner out of the neighborhood without a soul to see me. I couldn't stop thinking about what the fat guy would do when he woke up. He might not notice his wallet was lighter, but he'd definitely be pissed when he couldn't find his keys. He'd have a fit when he went down to the garage looking for them and realized the Mercedes was gone. The whole thing would sink in then. He'd call the cops and he'd stomp around the house looking to see what else I'd taken until they got there. It would really hit him when he found the empty peach can on the end table. Eventually, he'd remember hearing the fork tap the bottom of the can. He'd turned around once, but he hadn't really been looking. He felt safe in his home until that night. All people did. They had to. Otherwise, they'd go nuts jumping in every noise and shadow. They knew there were criminals out there, but not in their houses, not while they were home. The poor guy wouldn't sleep for weeks. He'd turned the night over and over in his mind until he realized he'd picked up the clicker just a few feet from where I was hiding in the shadows against the wall. He'd be terrified then. He expected criminals to be violent and unpredictable. He never expected someone like me. I never panic. I know the cops take 20 minutes to get most places, and that's more than enough time to disappear if you're not in a rush. I always plan 2 exits, a hot one and a cool one. I always keep my head, and most of the time, like that night, I glide along the cool road home, careful not to get stopped. Unfortunately, I had no idea who I'd just hit, or the shitstorm I was about to set off when I sold those credit cards.
Everybody for coming back and staying with us and joining us, because we're going to be having author Andrew Kaplan coming here on to the show in about 30 seconds, and I just wanted to thank all of the guests that we had on here on the show today, starting with Paul French, who did Midnight in Peking, to Donald Alan Kurtz with his book Manchester House, along with all the other things Donald does, to just having Robert Bennett on with Blind Traveler's Blues and his stuff. Along with the three audio clips we were able to play, which were Rabbit in the Moon by Deborah and Joel Sheelan, Blood is Pretty by Stephen Paul Lavia, and then we just had our friend CJ West and his audio clip book of The End of Marking Time. Another one that we want to let you on is Joshua Graham has a launch party that's going on with his book, and called The Dark Room, and we want everyone to go check out, you know, Joshua and see what he's up to. We put that stuff on our Facebook page, and we want people to, you know, check everything out, because there's so many authors that are going on, and, you know, anything that we can kind of do to help, if you want to email us at editor@suspensemagazine.com to try to get more knowledge to your books and this and that, please do so. Like I said, Joshua Graham, May 1st is his Dark Room online party, so make sure you check that out. But right now, we're going to get to our final author here in the segment. Wrapping up the show with a bang is author Andrew Kaplan and his latest book, Scorpion Betrayal. And Andrew, we want to thank you so much for joining us today. How you doing?
Doing great, John. Glad to be on.
Yeah, so Scorpion Betrayal is out. And it's, you know, tell a little bit about the book and, you know, a little behind-the-scenes action of what's going on here, because you love to go things quick, paced, and fast. I mean, you are bam, bam, bam with the pages. So tell a little bit about, you know, what's going on with Scorpion Betrayal.
First of all, I'd like to say we're thrilled. We're the book has been on the BookScan bestseller list now for 4 weeks.
Ooh.
So we're absolutely thrilled. And Books on Board is ebook bestseller list as well, and so we're absolutely thrilled about that.
Congratulations!
Yeah, thank you. And this book is obviously a thriller, and it is one. And I guess the general comment that almost everybody makes is they can't put it down. And that's the way I try to write. My job is to keep the reader going, keep him hooked, keep him having fun as he goes through in this case, Scorpion's Betrayal is about an ex-CIA agent who is he's an independent. He in effect, he's a mercenary. He is contracted by different intelligence agencies, often the CIA, to go out and do very difficult missions. And in this case, and what this one's about, is he's hunting for a very, very dangerous and a terrorist who's incredibly smart. And incredibly dangerous, and I wanted, and the intelligence agencies know absolutely nothing about him. So imagine this: I wanted the reader to follow Scorpion's hunt on what is a seemingly impossible mission to find and stop someone about whom all the intelligence agencies in the world know nothing. They don't know what he looks like. He's a man who might be anywhere in the world, using any name, any language, any identity, any nationality. And you only have 2 weeks or less to do it. And it's that contest between a brilliant terrorist who truly intends to cause damage and major damage, and Scorpion, who is trying to stop him. And yet the two men have a certain affinity, even though they don't know each other, but as they hunt each other, they get a sense of their adversary. And in a lot of ways, they have a lot of things in common, if you like.
The one thing that I always found fascinating with, you know, authors like yourself that write, you know, fabulous, just fast-paced political thrillers, whenever you're writing about a subject like terrorism and you're writing about terrorists and something like that hits so close to home, of course, do you find yourself when you're writing it that you're keeping those ideas and those things that happened in mind, kind of a sensitivity issue, while you're writing a book like Scorpion Betrayal?
Very much. In fact, one of the things I really wanted to get to in this book, because I think we touch on a lot of one of the things that everybody says about this book is, and my work is as well, is that it's, you know, we even have, you know, quotes from CIA agents saying, you know, this is incredibly authentic. This shows really how intelligence agencies work. So, if you will, this is our reader will be able to lift off the top secret cover on this thing and see the way things really happen, not what's in the press, not what's in the media, because that doesn't give you a reality, and not what's in the movies, some other things. That's not really what's happening. But also, I wanted to explore what would make somebody be that kind of a terrorist. Someone who really wanted to hurt so many people, and not in a simplistic way, because the way it's portrayed in the movies and in some other books is that, you know, someone is told, go kill and blow yourself up for Allah or something like that, and off they go. You know, it's 72 virgins, here I come. The problem, no human being is like that. You know, I've lived in the Middle East for 4.5 years, and I can tell you no human being is like that. So I wanted to explore what would make someone do that, be that. What in their background or their childhood would forge them into a weapon? And I wanted it to be based in the real world, in real history, not taking sides, not propaganda, not nonsense. And this led me to a story of a child and the idea of telling that child's story, which is not the way you write a thriller, except now I had a real person. And from that, then ultimately match this person against Scorpion, two very brilliant and interesting antagonists.
And with your book and now that you've come out, because you know you have the War of the Raven and Dragonfire and your Scorpion and Hour of the Assassin, do you continually find it challenging to yourself that you have to constantly kind of maybe push the barriers a little bit, whether it's with your, you know, antagonist or like I say, the hero and the villain, and the outlining secondary characters and the settings and the things like that? Do you find yourself having to continually challenge and push the barrier that much further on the next book that you got coming out?
Yeah. When Scorpion Betrayal is, if in effect, a reboot of a series. It's the second book of a book that a best-selling book called Scorpion I had written years ago, mm-hmm. and I had resisted the idea of doing a series for a very long time. And even though publishers have been after me to do it, and it's been very successful. You know, there are writers like Lee Child and Vince Flynn and Brad Thor and so on, and they've all done very, very well with series characters. I had resisted, and the reason I had resisted was a number of reasons, but mostly that I remembered, for example, near the end of his life, Ian Fleming, who had done so phenomenally well with James Bond, and in fact, I actually worked on a James Bond movie as a writer.
Oh, that would be fabulous! I got them all.
Yeah, I worked on GoldenEye, and that was a great experience working with the Broccolis. But anyway, when Ian Fleming, near the end of his life, and I didn't know him, but what I read about him was that he was miserable. And the reason he was miserable, I think, is that he felt creatively frustrated, you know, and all anybody wanted was just another, you know, it was more of the same, another Bond book.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to paint myself into that kind of a creative corner, if you will. And so I resisted it. But when I finally decided to do it, to think about doing it, and it was my son who kind of talked me into it, and he said, no, you know, if you really want to get an audience these days, you really need to think seriously about a series, and you need Scorpion, because that's the one that everybody's always been after you to do. And so I thought, well, all right, I'm going to do it, but I'm going to set myself some rules. And one of the rules is it's got to be different from everything else that's out there. It's got to be interesting. And while each book is going to be absolutely unique, it's all going to be part of some overall saga. And so that it keeps it creatively interesting for me.
And the one thing, and I would just want to know, because when you're starting to write a series, and now that you've kind of just acknowledged that this is book two, after Scorpion was, I guess you want to say, the pseudo book one, even though you didn't write Scorpion to be a series, it would be safe to say that people can come out right now, read Scorpion Betrayal, and really didn't be able to go back and read Scorpion and not miss anything, because you didn't really write Scorpion to be a series, so there's not really that timeline kind of feature that's in a lot of them.
Exactly. And, as I said, the original book was written to be a standalone. Now, of course, it's part of a series, and I'm sure we'll be bringing that back out again. And one of the things we're really excited about is the next one's coming out very, my publisher is really excited. HarperCollins is very excited about what's happening with Scorpion Betrayal. And we've been getting just phenomenal reviews. People seem to be reacting to it just wonderfully and very much as I had hoped. And the next one, Scorpion Winter, will be coming out in August, which is phenomenally fast, because usually most series, they'll have a year between books.
Correct. Yeah, a year is about the norm, but you're coming down to 4 months, which that's amazingly fast, unless you already set it up ahead of time where you start to see some of these authors that have like a trilogy and they do like one every other month. But that was set up way ahead of time, where it doesn't sound like this was set up like that.
No, it wasn't. It was originally scheduled to be published around the end of the year.
Okay.
And
so they kind of blew that out of the water, didn't they?
They absolutely blew it out of the water. I was astonished when they told me that they were bringing it out so soon, and they really just want to capitalize on what's going on, and that's very exciting, especially because we think it's a really terrific book.
Yeah, and now is it going to have the scorpion kind of in the title? Is it going to be, you know, is that kind of what fans are going to be to expect when they do the series? So you're going to kind of have scorpion going on in the title, and then people are going to know that this is the next one in the series. Is that kind of how you guys have planned it out?
Yeah, we're branding. we're absolutely branding. We're borrowing a page from John Sanford, and Scorpion will be in all the titles. So you'll know it's a Scorpion book.
Well, you know, the one thing that I've done a lot of, I guess you want to say soul searching, I've done some writing on it, I've done a lot of research on it, is the idea of a series versus a standalone. And I have to say, from personal, only, and this is only personal feelings, is that I tend to like standalones better than series. And the reason why is just for the one thing that you said about Ian Fleming, was he became extremely depressed and bored and no longer felt like he was a writer, but more of a commodity, where they were just like, just put out another one, put out another one, and he felt he was no longer creative. And I think that with standalones, that you can always be creative because you're writing from scratch. Every time you start on your computer, your page is blank. And when you're writing a series, the page is no longer blank, it's kind of filled in, but now you have to fill in those blanks.
Absolutely. I mean, again, going back to, and it wasn't just Fleming. I mean, but going back to Fleming, you know, when you're starting to call your characters pussy galore, you're bored. I mean, you're just saying, Jesus, what is it I can do to make them stop? I'll be so outrageous that, you know, but I'll tell you what you can really see it in. Ian Fleming, one of the last books he wrote was a book called The Spy Who Loved Me.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite movies, too.
Well, but the movie has absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with the book.
Right.
The only thing that the movie and the book have, it with the Roger Moore movie and the book have in common, and I know I've talked about it with the Broccoli's, and the only thing that those two things, the book and the movie, have in common is the title, because the book is actually, first of all, it's about a woman. It's told totally from her point of view. James Bond doesn't even appear in it till the very, very end, because she's in a bad situation and he helps save her in upstate New York.
Okay. Yeah. No, not over in, it was like Greece or Italy or something.
Exactly. Under the water. The Mediterranean. Yeah, exactly. And with a mad, you know, megalomaniac billionaire wants
right.
to destroy the world.
Octopus kind of guy or whatever.
Yeah,
or whatever.
Exactly.
And
the thing about it is that it's really good writing, and it's very much a woman. And you can just feel Fleming being a very good writer.
Right.
And wanting to do that, but feel like he's in a straitjacket because, oh, well, okay, now I got to bring Bond in and do all this James Bond stuff. And I don't think he wanted to do it. Another thing that happened to me was I remember doing a signing at which there were a number of famous writers there. And I was chatting with a woman who had and I won't mention her name. She's a very nice lady, very attractive woman, and she had done six number one New York Times bestsellers in a row.
Wow.
And yeah, And so she and I were chatting, and she said she was thinking of doing a thriller. And I said, well, yeah, sure. And we met when I had just done my first book. So, you know, nobody paid the slightest attention to me. But she did, and we were having a nice chat. And I said, you know, I'm just kind of curious. You've done so phenomenally well with these other books, these women's books. Why would you want to change? And she said, Andrew, I have written 7 Xeroxes of the same book, and they want another one. I can't stand it. And so I thought, that isn't what I want to do, unless I can make it different. And the nice thing about, at least so far, the way it's working out, is that the Scorpion character is evolving. And his world is evolving, and he's evolving, and so that's going to keep it interesting for me, hopefully.
And that's the thing too, because when you wrote Scorpion, like I said, you had no idea that this was going to become a series. So did you have to kind of go back? Did you reread Scorpion to make sure that when you were going to go forward, that you didn't miss something? Because I'll tell you what, and you know this too, thriller writers will let you know if you screwed something up. That's going to let you know that. So
thriller
you
readers,
go back? Yeah.
Thriller readers will absolutely screw you up. Will let you know if you screw up. And sometimes, you know, they'll criticize you even when you get it right.
True.
You know, like for example, in one of the things that I've got in Scorpion Betrayal is he uses. Because he's moving around and he can't let anybody identify him, Scorpion.
Right.
And so very often what he'll do is if he wants to contact someone or someone, he will go into an internet cafe and he'll get on a machine there and he'll just log in. And when he's finished, he'll use some NSA software that will delete everything that he's done. And reset the clock and get rid of temporary files and so on. And I did that, and then I got criticized from a couple of readers who said, well, wait a minute. You obviously don't know that just because you delete stuff from a computer doesn't mean, and empty, you know, the deleted files folder doesn't mean that the stuff's really deleted. Well, I do know that, but I also said I'm using special NSA software.
Right, and that software ain't no joke.
Yeah, so no, you have to be very, you do have to be very, very authentic. And I'm lucky. One of the things that I've been told time and again is how authentic the stuff feels, how real it feels, how real locales are, I'm just thrilled with the response. Your own Suspense magazine said that my work was matches the best of Ludlum and then surpasses it. So,
yes, we did.
And I thought that was wonderful. I love you guys.
Well, you know, and that's one of the things, because there's just so many new authors and there's so many authors that are in this category that. If we, you know, we have to try to bring, you know, the people together and try to bring them in one place. And when we read something just as fascinating, you know, like you wrote, that's the kind of praise that, you know, we give. And that's one thing that we do, because we never write negative reviews. If we can't review it, we just won't review it. But we'll never crush anybody's work. But when praise is due, we give it. And it was due, and we give it. And that's what we do. So, we want to thank you. But. I think it's great that you're writing the series and that you've literally sat and you fought so much and so hard on making sure that you don't only make it different, but you take those little attention to details that you're going to have in there that hopefully the fans appreciate the amount of time that you are spending on those attention to details. Because sometimes they don't do that too. And I think that's kind of the... And I kind of disappointed in fans when they don't acknowledge the fact that the author has spent that much time in those things.
I know, I've been, I mean, again, that's one of the things that, that reviewers again and again have noted is how real it is. And it's real not only in the sense of the locales and the characters, but also in the sense of tradecraft, how agencies like the CIA actually do things. And
I think that that's even scary if we actually do know exactly how they do everything. I don't want to know. I want to think it's all fiction in everybody's book. I don't want to think that it actually happens.
I know, and you know, that's, you know, where the real war in terror, and that's where the real battle goes on, and it's absolutely unseen. The newspapers never report on it. The only time anything, and if they do, they usually, you know, they usually focus on something that's absolutely peripheral, like, you know, secret agents with a hooker or something, you know, you know, in Colombia or something.
Secret service agents with the prostitutes,
yeah.
I know.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And not focusing on what it really takes to keep the bad guys from actually coming after us, because the nightmare scenarios, such as the kind that I describe in Scorpion Betrayal, and sometimes it could be a very small thing that will trigger a much larger problem. But either way, it's those nightmare scenarios are very, very real. Those are the things that keep you know, people like the president and the Secretary of Defense and the director and the DCI and director of the CIA. Those are the things that keep those guys up at night. Not you know, who was out with a hooker.
Well, and I'll tell you what, and I'm just going to end it with this because we're up against the time. Just make prostitution legal, and then it's no story no more. That's what I feel.
Well, that's the funny thing is they weren't breaking the law. It is legal in Colombia.
There you go. Just let it go. Just let it be legal. Yeah. I mean, they're having their fun. Come on. They got to have some downtime, too. I'm tired of people. It kind of gets on my nerves when people say, oh, Obama's taking a vacation. Do you really think the poor guy is on vacation? Do you not think that the phone is not up to his ear and he doesn't have everything going on? Just because he's not actually wearing a suit and in the White House doesn't mean that the man's not working 24/7. Just look at what he's done to him in 4 years, how he's aged. The man looked young, now he looks old. Don't tell me he ain't working, because I just think that that's a bunch of malarkey. They work all the time.
And by the way, that's true of, if you'll notice, you know, look at the photos of all the presidents.
Yeah, they all age.
You know,
they
look at George
work.
W. Look at his father. Look at Bill Clinton. They, you know.
And then when they're not president, they start to get that youth back.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so the American people need to get off the fact that all these people just hitting on all these politicians and everything else, because that's one job people say, I would never, ever, ever, ever want to be president of the United States. Never in a million years. Because half the people like you, and most of the people hate you. That's just the way it goes. I mean, and I just couldn't handle that. So,
yeah,
couldn't handle that pressure. Good luck to them. But, Andrew, I want to thank you so much for coming on today. I mean, it has been fascinating. We'd love to have you back on. You know, it looks sound like in August to talk about the third book now in the series. We can now say it's the third book in the Scorpion series. So,
yes, it is.
Yeah,
Scorpion Winter.
Let's do it.
Yeah, Scorpion Winter will be out in August. Let's do it.
Fabulous. Thank you so much, Andrew, and you have a great day.
You too.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Again, everybody, that was Andrew Kaplan, author of Scorpion Betrayal. You can find andrewkaplan.com for any more information, and go back and read Scorpion, and then read War of the Raven, Dragonfire, Hour of the Assassins, all the books that Andrew's written, because you definitely will not be disappointed in the least. Well, I want to thank everybody and all the guests that we've had on the show today, from, you know, Paul Bennett to now Andrew Kaplan to Donald Allen Kirch to Paul French. We love all of you. We want to thank all of you, and we will see you all in a couple weeks. I kind of forget when it is. Check out SuspenseMagazine.com. Click on Suspense Radio for more information. We'll see you all then. Enjoy, everybody. Keep reading.